great. I'm so short, I can just kind of disappear.
Oh, yeah.
My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
First, I want to thank Sam for asking me to speak tonight. I don't speak a lot. I haven't spoken for a long time about my story, and I'm really nervous in front of people, so I'll say that up front. But I also am a firm believer in service, and if you've been asked to speak, you comply. And the fact is, my story isn't an exciting one. I'm sorry to say. There'll be no great... you won't be leaving tonight going, wow, that was a dynamic story or anything like that. But I am a drunk, and it was told to me early on that even the mundane stories need to be told so that people can identify with it. So I'm going to do that. Now, I've never been to jail. I've only been arrested once for DWI. Only an alcoholic would say that with shame. I've only been arrested once for DWI. I'm so sorry. I've never lived out of a dumpster, and I never tried to cheat people, even in the height of my drinking. I was that drunk who would go to the bar the next day to make sure my tab had been paid, because I drank till I blacked out all the time. And I don't know if I was doing it because I wanted to be honest or if I was doing it because I wanted to go back to that bar, but that's what I would do. I never hurt anybody physically when I was drinking, but I did a lot of emotional damage to my family and to my son and most of all to myself. I'll start a little bit just to tell you a little bit about where I'm from. I came from a dysfunctional family. I'm not terminally unique in that sense. Many alcoholics came from dysfunctional families, although not all alcoholics did. I know alcoholics that are in these rooms that came from kind, nurturing, loving families, but they still drank because this is an equal opportunity destroyer. I was born in 1952 in Lynn, Massachusetts. Yes, I'm an old fart. And my father was a draftsman for General Electric there, and my mother was a housewife. And I used that term housewife very loosely. She lived in our house, and she was my father's wife, and the similarities kind of stopped there. My mother had been suffered from severe depression, and she'd been going to a psychiatrist her entire adult life. And back then, psychiatric care wasn't as good as it is now, and they prescribed Valium for depression, which today would have been poo-pooed in the medical profession. But it didn't take her long to develop an addiction to the Valium. So most of my memories of my mother were her sitting on the edge of the couch with her hair in curlers, holding a cigarette down to the ashes, down to her fingers, and in a catatonic state. And that was kind of the way my family was. Now, my mother had good reason to be depressed, so I'm just going to tell you a little brief side story about my family. My mother got married when she was 16, and she had my son, her first son, my oldest brother, Mark, from her first marriage. She then, when they were having marital difficulties, she went to live with her adopted father, who also happened to be a pedophile, and came back a year later pregnant with my brother Steve. In the meantime, her mother remarried a man, and this man fell in love with my mother and convinced my mother to leave her husband and to marry him. And her ex-husband, in retaliation, married his mother-in-law. So this doesn't have a lot to do with my story, but it's like the most interesting thing about my life. And I didn't want you falling asleep, so I thought I'd throw that in there. When I was 11 months old is probably the first time I kind of found out that I didn't always drink what I should drink. And at 11 months, I could walk. I could walk at a very early age. And my mother was in one of her rare non-catatonic states, and she was painting the kitchen. And she put a glass of turpentine on the kitchen table to rinse her paintbrushes. And I got up, toddled over to the table, grabbed the turpentine, and I drank it. Now, most normal children probably would have sipped, taken one sip, made a face, spit it out, maybe cried a little and throw the glass down. But according to my mother, no, I drank the entire glass of turpentine. I may have made a face and decided it didn't taste good, but I drank it anyway. And naturally, I was rushed to the hospital. They pumped my stomach. And I still have the newspaper clipping at home from the Lynn paper, Tot gulps turpentine. So I tell everybody when I was 11 months old, I already found out that I drank what I shouldn't drink in quantities that I shouldn't drink them. Then when I was 3 years old, my father used to give us wine coolers at Christmas time with a little thimble of Mogan David in it to help us go to sleep. Well, my brothers always fell asleep right away. They'd crawl up on the couch and sleep. But I always went, my dad told me I'd go over to him and say, no, I want more. Put more in. And I would still stay awake all night long for Christmas, no matter how much wine he put in that glass. And then when I was 7, we graduated to bourbon in 7. And I remember drinking a highball of bourbon in 7 in my Fred Flintstone jelly jar glass at Christmas time. And my father put a full shot glass in there and still could not get me to go to sleep. And so I was already developing a very high tolerance to alcohol at that time. And I was looking forward every Christmas to having my jelly jar glass filled with my highball. Now, I don't remember having a lot of friends growing up, mainly because my mother, every couple months or so, decided it was a good time to try to off herself. And she'd do it through sleeping pills, either overdosing on sleeping pills or for opening a vein with a razor blade, which was her preferred method. So most of the girls in the neighborhood weren't allowed to play. They either didn't want to play with me or they weren't allowed to play with me. So I learned loneliness at a very early age. I call it my bag of feelings. So the first things that I fed my bag of feelings with were loneliness and the feeling that I'm not worthy. And these were feelings I was starting to develop that I would soon start drinking at. I would handle what was going on in my life usually by going to my bedroom, going into my bedroom closet, shutting the door, and sitting for hours in the dark. And I did that for two reasons. I did that to shut off everything that was going on in my life, my parents fighting, the ambulances coming, the police being called, and to just sit there for hours and dream of a better life. That's all I wanted, just a better life. And I remember at one point, I was convinced that I was going to be walking down the street and a limousine was going to pull over to the side of the street and Paul McCartney was going to get out and he was going to feel sorry for me and he was going to adopt me. And when I became an adult, he was going to fall in love with me and we were going to get married and live happily ever after. It didn't happen, by the way. So now I've got my little bag of feelings. I've got loneliness, I've got fear, and I've got not being worthy. And then as I got when I was 7 years old, my mother went into another mental institution for about a year, and she came out pregnant with my sister, who's 7 years younger. Well, my mother wasn't capable of taking care of her, so I was the one that ended up taking care of her. And at age 7, I was taking care of my sister. I was cooking. I was cleaning. I was even doing grocery shopping, and I was being the adult. And that added one more thing to my list of my little bag of feelings, and that was resentment. I resented my mother for having my sister. I resented the fact that I was having my childhood stolen from me. And it took me a long time to get over that. And I mentioned that I didn't have any girlfriends. I think my mother bought me a Barbie doll once, and I cut the head off of her. Other than that, I became a tomboy, and I like to climb trees all the time because climbing trees is something you can do by yourself and not feel lonely. And then as I got a little older, I started playing with my brother's friends. I'd play football and play war in the woods and play baseball, but sooner or later, my brothers got tired of me monopolizing their friends, and they told their friends not to play with me anymore. And that added to my bag of resentments. And I was thinking this morning that the one time in my childhood that I think I felt even a little bit of normalcy was on November 1963. I was in Mrs. Schultz's, and I remember the day so clearly because I felt so good that day. I remember being in Mrs. Schultz's fifth grade class, and I had my mother's Madras color maternity smock on, and we were having art class. And I was making a clay duck ashtray when my principal came in, and she was crying, and she whispered to my teacher, and she started crying, and we were told to clean up our art things and to go immediately to the gymnasium, which was also our auditorium. And in the gymnasium, there was a small chair, wooden chair on the stage and a little black and white TV, and Walter Cronkite was just putting down his glasses and saying, "The president died at Parkland Memorial Hospital." And I remember kids crying. And I remember being told to go home, don't come back until somebody on the news says the schools are reopened. Now, every day I would walk across the playground. You would come out of my class and you'd walk across this long playground to a little wooded area that had a little bridge. And you'd go over the little bridge because there was a creek there and up the concrete steps. And then you'd be in the urban area. I lived in Columbus, Ohio at the time. And I remembered that was my walk of shame every day, because I would walk across that playground and the kids would all be laughing and in their little cliques, and sometimes they would be laughing at my expense and saying, "Don't go near her, she's got cooties," or "Mother's in the loony bin," things like that, very hurtful things. And I dreaded that walk, and I would walk it and across that bridge and up those concrete steps, and I didn't feel even a little bit better until I got up to the street level, where I usually went in a different direction than the other kids. But on that particular day, the day Kennedy was shot, it was really quiet going across the playground. And kids were quietly sobbing. And kids that normally wouldn't even talk to me were talking to me. And I remember one little boy who was a straight-A student in my class that were telling all the kids that now we're going to go to war with Cuba and the Russians are going to drop the atomic bomb on us and we're all going to die. And now the kids felt fearful and they felt scared and they felt sad. And I remember a little girl, as I got to the bridge, looked at me and said, "Isn't this the saddest day of your life?" And I thought, no, no, it's not. This is a happy day for me because you're feeling the way I feel every day. And it was the first time I felt even a little bit normal. Then on my 16th, well, let me fast forward a little bit. On my 15th birthday, my mother got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, actually, on my 16th birthday, she got in. On my 15th birthday, she decided to get herself off of Valium. And her psychiatrist suggested she might want to drink instead. Like I said, this is not somebody that I think was approved by the American Medical Association, but that's what they did back then. They did crap like that. And so she became an alcoholic. And I started resenting her more, because when she was on Valium, she was at home. She was catatonic, but she was at home. But when she drank, we never had alcohol in the house. She'd go to bars to drink, so I never saw her. And then when I turned 16, she got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her biological father, by the way, got in 1 year before she did. So she got into these rooms, and then I never resented her more than when she got sober. It doesn't make sense now, but it made sense then. Because she was always at meetings. And if she wasn't at meetings, she was on the phone. And if she was on the phone, she was on the phone with her sponsor or on the phone with other women in the program. I didn't know how much she needed that time on the phone and how much she needed that time for her own sobriety until I got sober myself. But I resented her, and I let her know I resented her. And she did something for me that year that she had never done. She threw me a birthday party. I had never had a birthday party. I was 16 years old and never had a birthday party. And she invited three of my quasi-friends, which were really classmates. And I was, again, starting to feel a little bit normal for the first time. And that little resentment for my mother was lifting a little bit until she took me aside and said, "You know, Deborah, The only reason you only have three friends here is nobody likes you. You're too bossy and you're too controlling and nobody likes you. Now, I don't know if it's because she was trying to work her program and she heard it was an honest program and she was just trying to be honest with to let me know what was going on. I'd like to think she did not discuss this discussion with her sponsor in advance, but I decided I could manipulate her by letting her know how much she hurt me, but she could make it up to me by buying me a bottle of wine for my 16th birthday. Now, when I was a little girl, my father smoked and my mother smoked, and I used to play around with my father's cigarettes in his ashtray. And my father was always trying to break me out of, you know, you're too young to smoke, leave him alone, leave it alone. So one day he got tired of this, and he lit a Pall Mall unfiltered, handed it to me, I think I was four, and said, now smoke it until it's gone. Well, I took one puff, and I got about three shades of green, you know, and I never smoked again anything legal. And I think my mother thought that because this worked with the cigarettes, maybe it would work with alcohol. So she went out and bought me the biggest bottle of Pagan Pink Ripple she could find. If you never had the pleasure, it's kind of lighter fluid with an attitude. And it's the best wine 69 cents would buy you at the time. Well, I think she thought I'd take a couple sips and it would taste terrible and I wouldn't want it anymore. Or I might even take a couple glasses and I'd get sick and I'd never go near the stuff again. But it didn't have the effect that she had planned on. Instead, it did something wonderful. It introduced me to something that was wonderful in my life. It didn't make me feel pretty, didn't make me feel smart, didn't take the loneliness away, but it made me numb. And I discovered blackout drinking. And I drank in a blackout fashion from then on. After she found out her experiment wouldn't work, that was the last time she bought me wine. But I found out that I could find older boys, and if I gave them the money, they would buy me the wine on the condition that I would split it with them. Well, I had to earn a lot of babysitting money because I had to have more than one bottle. I wasn't going to split one bottle with them. But after a while, after maybe a year or two of doing it this way, they started wanting more than just splitting the wine. And I'd known what my mother had gone through, and I'd known what her childhood was like. And the last thing I wanted to do was give up my virginity. But when I was 17 and just a couple months from my 18th birthday and ready to graduate high school, I think I was actually, a couple months from graduating high school, I went to a party with one of these boys. I drank about a gallon of wine. I smoked my first joint. I dropped my first tab of acid. I lost my virginity, and I got pregnant all in the same night. Because that's kind of like my brothers and my sister. We all have one thing in common. We only have to walk into a room and sperm has to be in the general area for pregnancy to occur. We are very, very fertile people. And I remember for the first 3 months, I couldn't drink because I was sick 24 hours a day for the first 3 months. My father had taken me to the hospital a couple of times, not figuring out why I was so sick, because I was dehydrating. And one day I got sick at school, and one of the girls went and got the nurse. And the school nurse asked me, is there a possibility you might be pregnant? And I said, yes, I think I am. Well, this is 1970. And back in 1970, in most schools, if a girl was pregnant, even 1 week before graduation, she was kicked out. No ands, there were no exceptions. But I just lost it there in her office, and I told her about my family conditions, and I told her about my drinking, and I told her about how I got pregnant, and I told her how scared I was, and I guess she felt pity on me. I like to think my higher power was looking out for me at the time. And she made an agreement with me. I won't tell the school so that you can graduate, but you must go home and tell your parents. And I did. And my mom was very accepting of it. My father, not so much. He came around eventually, but his first thought, another mouth to feed. and he was already having a hard time making ends meet. He was snowed under with medical bills from that my mother had built up. So once I had my son, I stopped drinking for a while so I could take care of him. And plus, I didn't have the money for anybody else to take care of him. I didn't have a job. But then I finally got a job, and I moved away from home. Well, when I moved away from home, I used to get up every day at 5:30 in the morning to take two buses across town to my mother's neighbor's house, the only babysitter I could afford, and then take two buses to work. So I'd start the day leaving home at 5:30 so I could be at work by 9. And I did this every day. And I finally convinced my parents, you know, this isn't good for the baby. This is really bad for the baby. Having the baby out in the cold all the time, maybe it would be better during the weekdays if Peter, my son, stayed with you. And then I would just have him on the weekends. And I conned him into it, and they agreed to it. And then I was off to the races again. Now I had weekdays, Monday through Saturday morning, to drink as much as I wanted. And as soon as 5 o'clock came around, that's exactly what I did. And like I said, I drank till I blacked out. There's a speaker named Evan, and he talks about blackout drinking, and he talks about how blackout drinking is the greatest thing in the world because you can be at the party, but you don't have to participate. He says it's like the computer's on, but all there is fish. And you got to be older to understand the fish statement. But that's what I liked. I didn't want to feel good. I just didn't want to feel. And then I had a second mission in life. I wanted to be a good mother. And to be a good mother, I needed to go out and find a husband so I would have a father for my son. And the only place I knew to go find a man was in a bar. But the problem with finding the perfect man in bars is you end up with men who hang out in bars. And I would get sloppy drunk, and I'd go into a blackout, and I'd start off the night with Mr. Wonderful, and I'd wake up the next morning next to Mr. What's-His-Name. And usually by the time I came to, they were already gone, except once in a while they couldn't leave because we were in their apartment because I was too drunk to remember where I lived. And this went on for a long, long time. And then finally, I woke up on the floor out of one of my drunken stupors. I woke up on the floor of a neighbor's house. And the neighbor was a graduate student from Baghdad. And he was working on his PhD at Ohio State University. Now, I lived on campus at Ohio State. I wasn't going to school there. I lived there because that's where the bars were. And I could walk to the bars, and I didn't need a car. And you didn't have to walk very far to hit a bar. You couldn't spit without hitting a bar from where I lived. And that was just fine with me. And we ended up dating for a while and then moving in together. He was a Muslim, so he didn't drink. So I didn't drink. I didn't drink because I didn't want to. I didn't drink because he didn't allow me to. And then after a few years of living together, he packed his bags one day after he graduated and said, I took a job in Saudi Arabia. See you later. And then right back into my bag of feelings again, I opened them up and I threw that abandon and the unloved feelings back in there. And a year later, he showed up at my doorstep and said, let's get married. I said, you've been gone for a year. I haven't heard from you a year, and you want to get married? Yeah. Okay. And that's what we did. We went into Washington, D.C. We got married at the Islamic Cultural Center. We pulled two witnesses off the street, perfect strangers to be the witnesses. We got married, and then he went on a beautiful two-week honeymoon to Europe. I forgot to mention, I wasn't invited. He went with his mother and his two nephews on my honeymoon, and I stayed behind. Then he sent for me, and I moved to Saudi Arabia, where I lived for 2 years. Well, now I was in a real predicament because you can't drink in Saudi Arabia if you're a Muslim. It's illegal. The penalty for being caught drinking is death. And so, you know, it was, but I got a job as a local hire with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they used to give us these things called tea rations. And with your paycheck, you got these tea rations, and tea rations were two coupons that allowed you to go to the post exchange and buy 2 quarts of alcohol a month. The Saudi government overlooked it as long as the Americans did it on their own compound and didn't feed it to any Saudis or any Muslims. Now, the only problem is it's illegal for women to drive. And the only way I ever made it to the post exchange was with my husband, who wouldn't allow me to drink. So I would have to sign my tea rations over to my boss, who likes to drink even more than me. Well, maybe not more than me, but as much as me. And I rarely got the benefit of those tea rations. Every once in a while, somebody for a Christmas party at work or something might bring in some homemade beer or some homemade Kahlua or bring in one of their bottles. But I had to be very careful because I had a driver that drove me home every day. And if I had alcohol on my breath, they would turn me into the authorities. And both my husband and I would be imprisoned. And one of us, if not both of us, would lose our life. But that didn't stop me from drinking. You'd think that'd be kind of a motive, you know. Alcohol, death. Alcohol, yeah, I can live with those odds. That's not an issue. So when I lived in Saudi Arabia, I realized that my husband wasn't quite the catch I thought he was. And he was a different person once he got into his culture. He was emotionally abusive. He was very dictatorial. And he was physically violent. And for the most part, I did a good job of kind of humbling myself in front of him and staying out of trouble. But I was a dry drunk. And sooner or later, being a dry drunk is going to catch up with you. And so I was a little short-tempered. And I decision-making capabilities weren't always on full steam. And I remember one day him coming and getting me at work at noon. And he said, "Get in the car." And I didn't know what was wrong. I said, "What's wrong? Is my son hurt? What's going on?" He wouldn't talk to me. And all the way home, he wouldn't tell me what was going on. And all the way up the 4 flights of steps, he wouldn't tell me what was going on. And then finally we got into the house, and he grabbed me by the arm and dragged me into the kitchen and said, "You didn't make my lunch before you left for work." I said, "What are you talking about? There's a big bowl of homemade tuna salad, his favorite, in the refrigerator." He said, "Yeah, but you didn't put it on the bread." So at that point, I had had enough. And I took that metal bowl, and I walked over to the kitchen, and I threw it against the wall. Then I took 2 pieces of bread, and I slapped them on this tuna dripping down the wall. And I said, "There's your effing sandwich." I woke up about an hour later. I had several chipped teeth. I had a lot of bruises, and I was bleeding. My mouth was bleeding. And I said, "This is it. I'm leaving you." And he said, "Fine. Where do you want me to take you?" So he took me to my boss's house. And I stayed with my boss for a couple weeks. But it was the greatest couple weeks of my life because my boss had alcohol. And he liked to drink the way I drank. And we'd stay up all night long drinking. But after a couple weeks, his wife got tired of having 2 drunks in the house. And he got tired of sharing his tea rations. And I was asked to leave. So he took me back to my husband, and I lived with him for another year until I was able to come back to the United States. He had to do a conference in British Columbia, and he dropped me off in Columbus at my grandmother's house. Now, my grandmother was my mother's biological father's second wife, and she was a very sweet lady. She taught school for 50 years, and she had put up with my grandfather's alcoholism until he passed away. And like I said, he got into the program in, I believe, 1966. And she knew that I was just blowing off steam because my friends came and got me the first night. My friend's sister, or my friend's brother, owned a bar, and she took me to the bar. And she told her brother about how I'd just gotten back from Saudi Arabia and I hadn't had alcohol in 2 years. I didn't tell her about the alcohol that I managed to get. I just really played up the, "I haven't had a drink in 2 years. I got to make up for it." And she told him this story, and he went to his bartender and said, "Whatever she does, don't let her glass ever be empty. Keep filling it up." Well, I had already had like a couple glasses of wine, a couple whiskey sours. I'd never tried a martini, so I tried a martini. I had a couple gin gimlets, and I was now working on a salty dog. Oh, I actually have a thank you. And if you hadn't had a salty dog before, it's vodka and grapefruit juice in a tall glass with salt around the rim. And you know what grapefruit juice does to your metabolism. I won't go into detail, but you know what it does to your metabolism. So when they poured me back at my grandmother's house, the next morning I was sitting in the bathroom and she brought me a bucket because she knew the drill. You know, she'd been through this with my grandfather. And I had it coming out both ends. And it was even hard to throw up because my mouth was swollen from all the salt around all the rims of those. Because I drank 11 salty dogs. And they were in 16-ounce containers. And she kind of ignored it. And she just kind of laughed about it because she knew I'd been in Saudi Arabia and we were out celebrating. And she says, well, have you had enough? Did you learn your lesson about alcohol? And I went, yeah, sure. My head was pounding, my stomach was sick, and my friend showed up at my door and said, want to go again? Okay. And back to the bar we went. And I came home in the same condition that I'd come home in the night before. And after 2 or 3 days of that, my grandmother had my bags packed and sitting on the door when I came home. And it took me a long time to make peace with my grandmother again. And I never did get a chance to see her again after I got sober. So I never got to make my amends to her in person. But at this point in time, my husband was away for a year. We were still married. And I was drinking daily at this point. I still was functional. I still had my job. I didn't drink until after I got home from work. But I went to work with a hangover every day. And like I said, I blacked out with every time I drank, and that's the only way I would have it. That's why drinking in Saudi Arabia was so awful, is because I'd have a couple drinks and I'd just start to feel it. You know, I never could have enough to reach that blackout stage, and I really missed that. Blacking out was my friend. I didn't have to feel all the crap. I forgot to mention, when I was 12, I did get sent to live with my grandfather that was the pedophile. And I'll leave it to your imagination what happened there, but I had a boatload of shame and lack of love that went into the bag of feelings after I lived with him. I couldn't figure out why neighbors were poisoning his dog because I didn't know he was a pedophile. I just thought he was showing me love, but you're not supposed to show love like that to a 12-year-old. I don't want to start crying. So anyway, my husband came back. We moved to Chicago for a short period of time. Again, I had to start white-knuckling it again. I couldn't drink around him. And then 6 months later, we moved to State College, Pennsylvania, and I was white-knuckling it again. And then he decided after 6 months of teaching at Penn State, he could make more money in Saudi Arabia, and I told him I wouldn't go with him. And he said that was fine with him. And we filed for divorce, for a no-fault divorce, and he went off to Saudi Arabia. And then I found myself in a position of a part-time job, a child to take care of, not enough money to pay the rent, not enough money to buy food or pay for child care, and worse yet, not enough money to buy booze, you know. And buying booze was my priority at that point. So when my husband came back, we finalized our divorce. It was a mutual divorce. It was a no-fault divorce. I took him to the airport to put him on a plane, to what we call the State College Universal Park Airport and Sub Shop. It was a little trailer. It's just an inside joke. But and we parted friends, and he agreed he would come back and we would settle our accounts because we had money in a joint savings account. And I went to get $25 out of the joint savings account to buy groceries, really to buy booze, only to find out it only had $5 in it. And the day before, it had $80,000 in. He had cleaned it out. Left $5 because that was required for a joint account to keep it open. So I didn't know what I was going to do. And I used what money I had to drink at that problem, because that's what I did all the time. I drank at my problems. Didn't drink over them. I drank at them. And then finally my neighbor came to me and said, my husband's going to teach at Rutgers University for a year, and financially it'll be difficult for us to have two households. Do you want to share an apartment? And this was the answer to my dreams, answer to my prayers. Now I could I would have the money to drink. I convinced my employer to hire me full time. She worked nights and I worked days. I took care of her son at night. She took care of my son during the day. And she didn't work weekends, and I could go out bar drinking at weekends. Still looking for that man that was going to be the perfect father to my son, and still finding those guys that hang out at bars. So sooner or later, I transferred with my company down to Maryland. And when I transferred to Maryland, my son was a little older, and I found neighbors that would start taking care of him on weekends so I could go out on binges. But I didn't just drink on weekends. I drank in the evenings, too. And I still remember the look on his face when he would come in, and I would be half passed out on the couch with a couple empty bottles of wine on the coffee table, and he would just look at me and say, "Not again, not again, Mom." And it was that look that he gave me, that look of anger, disgust, disappointment, and pity. I could handle the anger. I could handle the disgust. I could even handle the disappointment, but I couldn't handle the pity. I didn't want anybody to pity me. And I drank like that for a long time. And when he was 18, or actually when he was 16, I came home one day and found him drunk. Because after all, the nut doesn't fall far from the tree. And I remember shaking him and saying, "Where did you get the alcohol? I somehow got on my soapbox. And you shouldn't be drinking, you're underage. And where did you get the alcohol?" And he hit me. And he had never hit me before. And he left to spend the night at a friend's house. And he came back and he said, "Mom, I'm so ashamed of what I did." And I said, "What I want you to do is I want you to go to school. And I want you to talk to your guidance counselor. And I want you to ask for the name of a therapist. Some kind of counselor that we can go to." And we started going to counseling. And we went to counseling 4 days a week. And the first day was my son and the counselor by themselves. The second day was my son, myself, and the counselor. The third day was just me and the counselor. And the fourth day was group session. But what I couldn't understand is my counselor kept asking me about my drinking. And I said, "I don't understand what you're talking about. We're here because my son has a problem." And she suggested going to ACOA meetings, which I did try for a while, and I thought, "This is great. This gives me something to drink over. You know, boy, now I can just blame my parents, you know." And I don't want to downplay ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, because they do a lot of good work. But for me, the message I heard was, it's your parents' fault. And I had somebody to blame for my drinking, when, in fact, my drinking was my doing and nobody else's. My parents never sat on my chest and poured alcohol down my throat. That was a decision I made. And when he was 18, I told him I'm going to move to Columbia, Maryland in 3 months. And he said he didn't want to go. And I said, "I didn't say you were invited. I said I was moving there." And that allowed me to drink all the time. And I did. And I drank at bars for a long time. Although there were two things that happened all within the same week that stopped my bar drinking. And one was I had gone to the bar and I had ordered 5 Manhattans straight up and drank them. And the bartender came over and said, "We've never seen a woman drink that much alcohol. I mean, a Manhattan is pure alcohol." And I thought, well, I better not tell them about the 2 bottles of wine I had before I came to the bar. And I don't remember much about the night, but I remember being driven home by the bartender. So the next day I got up as early as I could manage, and with a horrible hangover, I walked for 1.5 miles to the bar to retrieve my car to find it wasn't there. And I walked 1.5 miles home. What I hadn't remembered is they drove me home in my car, and I had passed it on the way to the bar. That was the first thing that happened. And then the second thing that happened is, in one of my drunken stupors, I offered to give somebody a ride home. And he got in the car, and he was giving me directions. Before I knew it, I was out in the middle of nowhere. And he held a knife to my throat, and he raped me. And I drove him back to the bar. And I apologized to him. And I didn't tell the authorities about the rape. I didn't tell anybody, because I was so ashamed. And again, I was back to those feelings of, I'm not worthy. But I didn't stop drinking. I just started drinking at home. And my MO every day was stop on the way home, buy a couple bottles of wine because one wasn't going to be enough, go home, order a 16-ounce pizza from Domino's, get a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke because that's what you drink with pizza, eat the entire pizza, drink the entire 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke, stick a finger down my throat, throw it all up, and then start drinking because I didn't want to throw up the alcohol. I rarely threw up the alcohol. I'd wake up on the bathroom floor, and I'd be laying there, and I'd think I need to go to bed, but I'd be laying there, and it smelled like urine, but I thought, yeah, but it's cold. It feels good on the tiles, and I can put up with the smell of the urine. And finally, one day, I had gone to the dentist that day, and I decided I was going to treat myself to a movie. It was a Friday night. And I got to the movie too early, and I thought, well, I'll go across the street to the bar, and I'll have a bite to eat. While I was sitting at the bar, because I never sat at the table because I was too embarrassed to sit alone, I already felt lonely enough. I didn't want to feel even more isolated. I sat there, and, of course, I couldn't make up my mind what I wanted to eat, so I ordered a couple glasses of wine just while I was looking at the menu. But we all know alcoholics only take one drink, and then the drink takes the drink after that. And before I know it, I'm driving down 29 South in Montgomery County. Now, I had been drinking in Howard County, and I lived in Howard County, but I was driving down in Montgomery County, and I saw the blue and red lights behind me. And I thought, this is it. My life is over. I had a job with a security clearance. I was going to lose the security clearance. I was the security officer. I was the one that judged everybody else. And I thought, this is it. It's all going to be over. And I don't remember the ride to the police station. I do remember being handcuffed to a table while one policeman went through my purse, and the other two policemen were in this little ante room off the side looking at my breathalyzer, and they actually gave each other a high five after getting the readings. I think I was like 5 or 6 times the legal limit. And I, by the way, I hadn't eaten that day, and I had been on pain pills as well. I was fortunate enough that I qualified for a diversion program, and part of the diversion program was you went to outpatient therapy 4 days a week, and you had to go to at least 2 AA meetings a week. And I thought, well, I can do that. I had to lie to get into the diversion program because you had to actually be a resident of Montgomery County, or you had to be, your employment had to be in Montgomery County. Well, my corporate offices were in Montgomery, so that's what I gave as my employer's address. And I took my little court slips they gave me. They weren't really court slips, but they were like the court slips they gave me, and I went to my first AA meeting. Now, I walked into my first AA meeting on August 8th, 1993. That's not when I got sober. I actually stopped drinking a couple weeks before that, mainly out of fear. But I took August 8th as my anniversary date because that's the day I made the commitment to get sober. And I went to more than 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to like 180 meetings in 90 days. I lived the program. I went to morning meetings. I had lost my job by now. And I got up every day and went to the sunrise meeting. Then I went to the noon meeting. Then I went to the 5 o'clock meeting at the Alano Club. And then I went to an 8 or 8:30 meeting at a church or at the Alano Club. And my very first meeting I went to was a traditions meeting. And it was on the 8th tradition, which has to do with that AA may employ service workers. Now, if this is your first meeting of AA, it's not really like a real topic grabber. It's not something that goes, yes, this is what I want. This is the fellowship I want. But it wasn't the meeting. It was the meeting after the meeting. Because when the meeting ended and I had introduced myself as a newcomer, I didn't say I was an alcoholic yet, just that I was new to the room and I had a court slip that needed to be signed. The women surrounded me. And they didn't ask me about my drinking. They didn't ask me why I was there. They didn't ask me what I had done when I was drinking. They told me their stories. and they asked me out for coffee afterwards. And if for the first time in my life, I felt friendship. I felt like I was worthy. And I wanted what everybody had. And I was on a pink cloud for about my first 6 months. I got off of it temporarily after a couple months because I hadn't gotten a sponsor yet. And I did the all-time worst step you can do, the 13th step. And I damn nearly went out and drank over that. And it's the closest in 23 years plus I ever came to drinking. And if you're new in the program and not familiar with the 13th step, it's when a man or a woman with more sobriety preys on people with less sobriety. And there's a reason why your sponsor will tell you don't get involved in a relationship in your first year of sobriety. Because you need to know you before you can share you with another person. And I loved this. I fell in love with this program. I tell everybody I fell in lust with it first. You know, just like men, you fall in lust with them first. And then after you get to know them, that lust becomes love. And that's what happened in this fellowship. And I took service jobs right away. And I got a sponsor. And I started working the steps. Because before I got a sponsor, I was trying to do the 112 step. I'm sober. Now I want to get everybody else sober. And then it was pointed out by one of the more senior people in the room that you can't give it away until you get it. You can't give away what you don't have. And that you need to get it first. And I listened at meetings. And I did what I was told to do. And I was told that you can't fall off a roof if you stay in the middle. And they explained to me the difference between being in AA and being around AA. And my whole social activities was based around this fellowship. And when I moved down to Virginia, I hated AA in Virginia. I hated it. You didn't do it right. You didn't do it like they did it in Maryland. You didn't do it right. You don't even say the Lord's Prayer the same way. You pause at the wrong time. What's wrong with you people? And I shared at a meeting once that I just am not bonding with the people down here. And then I heard somebody say something very wise that I've never forgotten, that you will never bond the same way with another alcoholic as you did with the people you got sober with. You will love them, you will bond with them, but it'll never be the same bond. That's a unique bond that you'll never share again. And once I realized that and accepted it, it made it a lot easier. And again, I took service jobs and I stayed around the program. And then I moved down to Culpeper and I stopped going to the rooms. I didn't drink, but I stopped going to the rooms. I used the excuse that I was working in Northern Virginia and I had to get up at 3:30 every day and drive to work. And then I didn't get home till 5 or 6 o'clock at night. And then by the time I had my dinner, it was almost time to go to bed again. And I used that excuse for a long time. And then, you know, it was pointed out that they have meetings on weekends. And we started going to the hospital meeting on the weekend. And then I retired. And at that time, I ran out of excuses. I have to get back into the program. And I asked someone to be my new sponsor because my old sponsor in Fairfax called me up one day and said, "How's it going with your new sponsor?" I said, "What do you mean, Maria? I don't have a new sponsor." She said, "Well, I just assume you did because you don't call me anymore." And that kind of hit home that maybe I need to get a sponsor. And I got a new sponsor. And I took service positions. And I chair a meeting. And I have a service position at the district level and a service position at the group level. And even though I'm scared to death to talk in front of groups like this, I was asked to share my story and I accepted because that's what we do. And AA has given me so much. One thing it's given me is a higher power that I thought had abandoned me, and I didn't realize that I had abandoned my higher power. That God's grace was there all along, but I had to accept it. I had to receive it. That nothing is given to you. You have to take it. And I learned that it doesn't matter if you have 24 hours of sobriety or 24 years of sobriety. It's quality of sobriety that matters. not quantity. And I realized that if I'm not in the program, in the middle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs, I don't have quantity or quality of sobriety. All I have is time. And time will eventually get me drunk. And I never, and I was taught that I'm always, no matter how sober I think I am, I'm always going to be one drink away from a drunk. And what I found when I stopped going to meetings is I was taking my sobriety for granted. I was wearing it as a loose garment. And instead of realizing that I'm still eligible, all those things I didn't do, I didn't go to jail, I didn't lose a house, I wasn't homeless, those are yets. And yet stands for you're eligible too. And I'm always going to have the yets. And I need to remember that. And I need to go to meetings on a regular basis. And I need to hold my hand out to alcoholics when they ask for it. And I need to know the difference between taking someone's hand and grabbing somebody's collar. That, you know, I recently tried to sponsor a woman that wasn't ready. And it was hard because I looked at it as a failure. And my sponsor pointed out to me that she'll come around when she's ready. But you can't make her ready. You can't give her something she doesn't want yet. And that's hard to accept, but it's the way it is. This fellowship never taught me how not to drink. That's not what AA is for. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches you how to live your life in between the drinks so that you don't find it necessary to take that drink. And I didn't just have a drinking problem. I had a thinking problem. And just not drinking wasn't, the same person will drink again, and just not drinking wasn't going to prevent me from going back out. I needed to change the way I thought. I needed to change what I did. And I needed all of you. So now I go to meetings on a regular basis. I have a sponsor. She knows she's my sponsor. I don't have to call her very often, but the couple times I've had some crisis in my life, she's always been there. Even if she's been on travel, she's always been there to pick up the phone for me. And for that, I'm grateful. I love you, Shirley. And now I am going to cry. And every day I pray, and I learn not to pray for the things I want, but for God to give me what I want, but to give me what I need. And what I need and what God thinks I need are not always the same. And I also learned to know that he has three answers. No, that's not for you. Yes, that's for you. Or maybe, but you're not ready yet. And I have to accept that. And I'm a person that wants everything yesterday. And that was a hard lesson to learn. I learned to be more tolerant of people. But I have a prayer that I do every night. It's actually a bookmark that I keep. And I just wanted to end with that because I know I've rambled on. And see, I never even looked at my notes. I'm sure it would have been a better meeting, had I. But for people that are new in the program, you'll see camels on things associated with AA. Well, there's a story behind the camel. And I'm going to read this from Dr. Bob, one of the founders of AA. Dr. Bob, physician and co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, would explain prayer by telling how the camels in a caravan would kneel down in the evening and the men would unload their burdens. In the morning, they would kneel down and the men would put the burdens back on them. It's the same with prayer, Dr. Bob said. We get on our knees to unload at night, and in the morning we get on our knees again. God gives us just the load that we are able to carry. And the camel prayer actually goes, the camel each day goes twice to his knees. He picks up his load with the greatest of ease. He walks through the day with his head held high and stays for the day completely dry. So thanks for letting me share.